Kathy Bowe will be speaking on behalf of herself, Michael Christie and Brian Devlin. Because I was speaking to Kathy yesterday, I know she comes from Charles Darwin Uni, and she's going to be talking about mobilising the living archive of Aboriginal languages.
Thank you. So I want to acknowledge my colleagues, collaborators in this project, so Michael Christie and Brian Devlin from Charles Darwin University, also Jane Simpson from ANU, which is one of our chief investigators. We're funded through an ARC linkage, LEAF grant, which you've already heard about in the last couple of days. We actually got renewed this time, which we're very pleased about. Our partners in the first stage have been the Northern Territory Department of Education and ANU, and we also want to acknowledge the technical team at CDU Library who are actually hosting our archive, and also the staff at the remote schools that we've been dealing with to collect the materials. So the background to the project is that during the era of bilingual education starting in the 1970s, the government set up literature production centres so that the schools would have materials to enable the children to learn to read and write in their own language. And there are these incredible stories from more than 25 different Australian Indigenous languages. And since the decline of bilingual education in the last decade or so, a lot of these books are being lost or damaged or sometimes even deliberately destroyed. We have this opportunity now to preserve them while they're still available, and we've got the digital facilities to make that happen. And obviously the internet provides ways of not just storing the materials but allowing access to them as well. And beyond that, we also want to be able to reconnect the materials to the communities of origin. So this is the map of the Northern Territory, and the coloured sections are the language areas that have materials in our archive, and they're listed on the right-hand side. And the points are the locations of the schools that had literature production centres or literacy centres where the materials were produced. And the large grey area in the middle that didn't get bilingual education programs in those languages, but we are looking at including those in the future. So today I want to talk about developing the archive, how we built the infrastructure and populated it with the digital materials, accessing the archive, and I'll show you our website as it stands at the moment and mention a few of the challenges we faced, and then talk about the next stage of our project to mobilise the archive, connecting with the materials and enriching them, and our plans for the future. So what's in the living archive? Well, it's, as I mentioned, it's materials produced at those literature production centres or LPCs in remote territory schools that had bilingual programs. And these materials include teaching materials and literacy primers. We've got lots of children's stories, both traditional and modern. A lot of them were based on transcribed recordings of the old people telling stories. There's many stories of local cultural significance, dreamings, histories, natural science, instructional, cautionary tales, ethnobotany, and quite a few translations or adaptations from other languages, including English and other Indigenous languages. So that's some of the covers of books in our archive that we've collected. We've also got brochures and posters with some of those on there as well. And the contents of the book, there's quite a variety of different types of content, often one sentence and an image per page. Some of the images are digitally coloured in more recent years. Many are just hand-drawn line drawings. Some of the writing is even handwritten, and some are quite heavily text-based with fewer images. And each of the literature production centres and schools has a unique history of bilingual education and the resources that were created. And there are still some schools hanging in there and continuing language programs today. And with still a few literature production centres still functioning. Most of the others have turned into photocopy rooms or junk rooms. And as I mentioned, some of the locations actually destroyed the remaining materials. They were taken off to the tip because no one was using them anymore. In one case, a missionary actually found the stopped the truck that was on its way to the tip with boxes full of books on the back and salvaged a whole lot of things from there. In other places, the material's being well looked after. Beyond the stuff that's still in the schools, there's also materials in libraries and in private collections, which we haven't got to yet. So some collections in the schools look like this, quite nicely ordered with labels. You can find things. This is in a resource room in a school where the kids can actually go and look at the materials. In one place I went to, it looks like this, in a very hot, dusty, spider-filled shed. But that second photo is also inside. They have a nice archive display with drafts and master copies with nice metadata on the labels, on the folders as well. So there's quite a range of how the material is being stored today. So we're taking all these materials, digitising them and putting them online. So the first step in the process is to identify what the materials are. And in some cases it's easy, there's nice lists of metadata, who wrote them, when, where. In other cases there's nothing, not even a title that we can identify. So we're creating catalogues of the metadata that we can identify, and also supplementing with information from the communities where they say, I know who wrote that story, I recognise those pictures. We're creating digital versions using different mechanisms. So this one is one that the Northern Territory Library lent us, with a camera mounted on a frame with the lights, and you take a photo of each page. The one at the CDU Library has a two-camera setup. In some places, they're just put on multifunction printers or a photocopier and sent to us. So there's quite a range of qualities of the materials that we're getting also. We're digitising the materials. We're using optical character recognition to create text versions, which is an interesting endeavour in itself. Many of the languages have special characters. You saw some of the handwritten materials. Some of the fonts are not very clear. Some of the images and the text overlap each other. And we've got the people we've got working on the OCR and don't know the languages, so they're checking what the software produces, but they don't know the language, so they can't always pick the errors. We're storing these digital versions on the eSpace digital repository at CDU Library. And the next step is to publish the materials online. So going back to the creators and seeking permission, which I'll talk about in a moment, and developing an interface to enable people to search and access the materials. At the moment, we've got about 2,000 items that have been uploaded to the repository, and about between 500 and 600 of them are already available to the public, and there's still others that are awaiting permission to make public. There's about another 500 that have been digitised, OCR, the metadata's been checked, and they're ready for upload. And there's about another 1,500 items in various states. Some are digitised but haven't yet been OCR'd, some are sitting in a pile on the floor of my office. And there's more books, as I mentioned. We haven't been to all the libraries around or private collections. We've had a few people donate collections to us, and we haven't worked through all of those yet. I'm expecting around 4,000 to 5,000 items in total. The funding was given to us to produce a research infrastructure for academic use, and so it's completely open access. There are no restrictions, so it's unlike some of the other archives we've heard about in the last couple of days, or even like IATSIS, where there are certain permissions that you need to have to access the materials. Ours will be completely open access. And because we want it to be used not just by academics but also by Indigenous users, we wanted to think of different ways that they might want to access the materials. So we've got a very visual website with a map-based interface, putting the covers of the books rather than having to search by text. And I will show you that now. So we've developed a front end to the eSpace collection. It's meant to be suitable for a variety of devices. At the moment, it's not great on mobile devices, and we're still working on it. So I'll show you where it is at the moment, but it is changing. Why don't you get that? I need to push another button.
Then it screws up the resolution.
I had it on both Safari and Chrome, so.
What's the resolution?
It's visible though. Mm-hmm. So it's, yeah, it's even worse on this one. So it's a map-based interface, the same as the map we looked at before, where each of the points activates a little window. So if you click up here, this is the Yolngu area, which is cut off, but if you could see the rest of it, there's three locations where Yolngu language materials are, from Galliwinkor, Milingimbi and Yirrkala. There's about eight different languages from there, and you can click on any one of those and you get a warning about the contents, how they can be used. It's just a click through, and then you get, so this is the Dango language. I won't go into the issues of ISO language coding, but you'll see there are two books there, the Daki Daki books, which both say they're in Dango. Actually, one of them's in Wangari, and the other one is in Galpul, Ngai Mil, and Gualamala. But according to ISO, they're the same language. So even though they're different books, they're different languages, they actually end up in the same ISO code. And unfortunately, you can't see over that side where there are some filters that you can actually go through. But if you click on a book, let's click on the Frog book, you get some additional metadata, as much as we could find about that book. And when you click on Read, it opens, goes to the next one, it should open the PDF. So when we digitise them, we've got individual TIFF files of every page of the book, which are our preservation copies, and then we've created PDFs as presentation versions. And you can scroll down and read the entire book. And as well as that, you can view the text file. So that's useful for more linguistic research, if you just want to look at the text file without the images. If there's a translation of the book, then that's linked to the to they're all related together and you get a different version of the same book. And if there's an audio file, which we've only got a handful of at the moment, then you can listen to the audio as well. And we're looking at how to get EPUB books up there where you've got the sound, the text and the image all together. We've got the traditional browse options. You can browse by place, all places that have had bilingual programs, browse by language, again by ISO codes, and browsing by author, author or illustrator, and browsing by title. And here you get, as I say, it's very visual, so you get all the cover images of the books, and you can sort them by title, by date's not working at the moment, but by popularity, which ones have been looked at most. You can view it as a list and so on. And then on that side that you can't see, you can actually filter by place or language or whatever else. You can do search words. If there's a text in English, either a, like a translated title or the entire text is in English, you can search by English words, or you can use language words. And then, again, you could filter. If you can see that right-hand menu, you'd be able to filter on that as well. So that's a quick look at our website. We'd love to get your feedback on that if you'd like to share with us. Okay, some of the challenges that we face. One is about ownership of the materials. So the Department of Education owns the copyright on all these materials because it was produced under their on their watch, and they've given us permission to digitise and display these on our website, and we're actually working out the wording of a licence for that. We wanted to get into things like Creative Commons, so people want to reuse some of these materials, but because we don't own the copyright, it's up to the department to give us that. And I don't know if it's been publicised down here, but the Department of Education in the NT has been slashing jobs left, right and centre, so I don't think we're high on their priority list at the moment to work out wording for our licence. Beyond the copyright issue, we also want to acknowledge the moral rights of the creators. So we're actually going back to the communities and talking to people and saying, that book that your mother wrote or that you wrote 30 years ago, we want to put it on the computer and have everyone in the whole world able to view it. Is that okay with you? And we've got a little permission form that we get them to sign. And so far, everyone's been very positive about it. We haven't had any negative responses. We've had a few interesting questions about it, because in some communities, people have been ripped off by white people coming along and saying, we want to do this nice, these nice things with your materials, and they don't get anything back. So it's important for us to talk to people about what we're doing with that old stuff, and family members of those who passed away, and just get their okay with what we're doing. At the moment, we're only uploading, we're uploading everything, we're only making public those we've got signed permission slips for. That's why there's only about 500 to 600 items on there now, but 2,000 sort of ready to go. Still a lot to do. We want to improve the interface. We tested last week with a few Indigenous users, and they had different responses to what we had with academics or other white fellows who actually used it, so we're going to do some revision of the interface. Photo books are an interesting challenge. Some communities are fine, post, put all the photo books up, we don't mind. Others are a little bit more hesitant. So we're trying to work out a way of putting some kind of warning up there that says, this book is going to contain photos. And we're just still working out exactly how that will work on the site. We want to use the OLAC and OAIP image harvesting protocols to get our stuff more disseminated, more accessible through the various mechanisms that those things offer. Permissions and licensing, I already mentioned. There's still more people we have to chase up. Some of the schools in our project were from the Catholic Education Department, so that's separate to the Department of Education, and so we have to get license from them to post their materials. It's also interesting what I think Gary talked about yesterday, some of the draft versions and different editions of things and who's responsible for those type of things. We've ended up with material from outside the bilingual schools program, which we don't really have a permission to use, but we've got it digitised and it's useful stuff. What can we do with it? So going back to organisations like SIL, and there was the Australian Languages Fortnight where they used to run writing workshops, and we've got some material from there as well. That's not technically under our purview, so we have to work out what to do with that. Uploading more records and thinking about crowdsourcing processes. So I mentioned that the OCRing process, there's still lots of errors in that. We want people who are literate in the language to be able to look at it and correct it for us. And how we actually make that happen, we're still working on. That's part of what we want to do in stage two, which is also to reconnect the materials with the communities. And that's been interesting in the last couple of days, hearing about those repatriation questions and how people are managing that. So we've just been funded for stage two, which we want to really mobilise the Living Archive. Our original goals were preservation and access of these materials, and so it had the basic structure of a traditional archive. But now we want to develop more Indigenous approaches to acknowledge the language authorities and local knowledge and engage them with the materials themselves. And we're trying to work out the technical configurations to support that kind of communication and collaboration. So we've got our new LEAF funding is still with ANU and the Department of Education, but we're also adding in Batchelor Institute, Northern Territory Libraries and the Catholic Education Office. And we're going in four different directions with the stage two. First one is search and rescue. So we started with the materials from the bilingual programs, but we want to add more materials by Indigenous authors in Northern Territory Indigenous languages. So the grey space in the map we want to turn into colour, finding materials that were produced in those places in those languages. So working with linguists and language workers to collect some of those materials. And not all of it will belong in our archive itself, but working with the NT Library and Batchelor Call Collection, some of it might be filtered to different places as well, and possibly even Paradisec or ATSIS or other relevant archives. The second one is local level engagement, so providing resources for ongoing language and culture work at the local level, where the materials have been produced but often forgotten, because the bilingual education is no longer in play in many of these places, but allowing the local knowledge and language authorities to supervise their own collections and how they might be used both in the school and outside of the school, and encouraging that intergenerational transmission of the language and cultures in the communities as well, using the books in the archive as a means to facilitate that. The third one is classroom engagement, incorporating the resources into the classrooms. And at the moment, with the Australian curriculum, there's a draft framework of Aboriginal languages and Torres Strait Islander languages pathways. And there are three pathways, one for first language learners, second language learners, and language revival learners. And the materials in our archive can fit into each of those pathways. And also across the entire curriculum, there's this priority of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander histories and cultures. So even students in Sydney or Melbourne can also engage with some of the linguistic and cultural information inside the books in our archive. There's a lot of policy discussions about education in the NT, and language is not looking good at the moment, but the fact that the Department of Education is partnering with us in this, maybe we can facilitate some kind of activity in that space. And there's lots of linguistic, cultural and technical opportunities in the classroom, so the kids can take the books, record the old people reading the stories aloud, turn it into a video or an e-book, all sorts of things like that, which actually uses quite a few different skills, and we've got a few teachers at the moment working on ideas that they can use in the classrooms for next year in that area. And the fourth one is academic engagement, connecting interested researchers worldwide with the knowledge authorities from those communities. So creating opportunities for researchers to engage with the language owners and enrich the collection through collaborative research. And there's so many ideas we've got. It's interesting that Northern Territory has an incredible collection of live languages, but there's no linguistics department at CDU. So there's students around Australia and around the world who can access all this stuff and do some interesting things, still in connection with the people who still use those languages in the communities. So we're planning an event in March next year to create some kind of network of engagement with the archive So if you've got ideas about that, let me know. We'd be happy to include you in that discussion. So we'd love you to try out our website and give us feedback. I've got some posters and some brochures to decorate your offices or help us promote the archive. If you've got ideas about crowdsourcing edits to text and metadata, we've got newsletters and Twitter feeds. And if you've got ideas about how you'd like to connect with Stage 2 activities, we'd love to hear about it.
Thank you, Cathy. A lot of good food for thought there. Any questions?
Hey, thanks for that. I have a couple of different questions. One is, this content reminds me of a set of materials produced in Alaska by something called the National Bilingual Materials Development Center. In the early 70s, early to mid-70s era. Those materials are kind of interesting because some of them were originally created, but then a lot of them were essentially copied. Right? So there was a template from one language, and then somebody would try to translate, sometimes very curiously, across language families and things. I was wondering if that's the case with any of these materials? Or are they
not so much. Mostly they were locally produced of their own stories. There was a little bit of sharing across different locations. The only similar thing, there was a group from Chicago called Science Research Associates who had a little set of yellow books that had pictures but no text, and each community was sent a packet of these to write the stories. And so we've got these stories in all different languages across the collection. And there were some interesting stories. There's a book on elephants in there and one on pandas and clowns and things that just don't sit very well in our collection. But the way they've translated them is linguistically interesting. But otherwise, there's a few stories that appear in different places. Some of the translated stories, like The Very Hungry Caterpillar, makes a few appearances. Are You My Mother is quite a common one that comes up, but not a systematic one like you're describing there.
That's good. Excellent. If I may, one other question. I don't want to get us off topic, but it's maybe a naive question. Can the government really hold copyright in Australia?
Yes, the Department of Education, because they employed the people who did it, and so anyone who worked for the Department of Education signed over their intellectual property for those materials, and
right.
So the department does own copyright.
Yes,
so
under Australian copyright law, in fact, governments can hold copyright, which is not always the case in other countries.
So that's why we felt it important to go back to the people who wrote the stories and drew the pictures and said, is this okay what we're doing now?
I was just interested. I see that you brought the Northern Territory Library in, and I know that they produce some resources in different languages
yes.
A few years ago. I'm assuming that's part of what might be
possibly. I'm not sure if they're the ones that were commercially produced, and we're tending to avoid those because we don't want.
No, they weren't commercially.
Not the baby board books, is it?
Yeah,
not
but
the
they
ones?
Were. They weren't for sale.
Okay.
No, they were actually just. I mean, they are the baby board books.
Okay.
They weren't for sale. At least they weren't when I was.
Okay. Well, we haven't talked about those in particular, but more about their community stories software, which I think Lisa mentioned earlier, similar to the WA one, where communities can upload their own photos and videos and texts and things. And connecting with those kind of facilities. And they also do training in communities for digitising and uploading and those kind of things.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Are you either working towards getting material from South Australia and Western Australia, or do you know of projects in South Australia and Western Australia that are doing something similar?
No to both of those. We've decided to limit it to the Northern Territory at this point. If in the future we got more funding and could expand it. The software we're using and so on is available for other people to draw on. We're happy to share that. But I don't know of anyone else who's doing it. And we're not, at this stage, intending to extend beyond the territory borders.
Well, sorry, if somebody were to offer you a collection that was digitised and had the metadata in the right shape, would you be able to incorporate it?
Let me think about that
maybe.
One.
You might have answered this, but are you dealing with any audio, video recordings that might have been made in this program?
There's audio isn't really in our purview. We'd love to have it, and people who've looked at the site have said, wish I could listen to that story as well. We've got a few, people have given us a few digital stories, readings of the stories in the archive, and we're trying to match those up where we can. We've only really made a start on that. We're concerned in stage two we're going to end up with boxes of tapes and things that we just don't have the facility to digitise. We're still focusing on books and augmenting those. So just a recording on its own, not so much, but if it's a recording that goes with one of the stories, then we certainly incorporate that.
Yeah.
But I think that's one way of enhancing the archive, bringing it to life even more than just the picture books that you can. They're a bit static on the screen, but having the audio really makes a difference, especially with people who can't often can't read and write that language, but they can hear.
Can I ask a question there? It was on T. Well, it sort of relates to both the papers. You were just talking about the audio and the linking. What are you marking up in that?
For the audio?
Well, I know Nick uses TEI to mark up the Days of Eight, but we use TEI to mark up text that links to audio, and I was just wondering what you're using as the markup and how it would facilitate.
I'm keen to learn more about the TEI stuff. At the moment, we're using HTML5 to link audio and text.
Yep.
But we're trying a few different things.